When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Screen Talk, Indie Wire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, joined as always by Ann Thompson out in Los Angeles. I'm back in New York. We had Telluride last weekend, and of course, that was a wild rush. And now we're here basically to spend the entire time talking about the Matrix trailer, right, Ann? Did you get a chance to to catch up on that one?
So what's the whole thing with Lawrence Fishburne? What's the deal with that?
This is fascinating. So Matrix was an early example of transmedia, and you really couldn't understand what happened in 2 and 3 unless you played the video games, watched the Animatrix shorts, and read the comic books. So in the video games, Morpheus actually died. So it's canon that Morpheus died. So why is Morpheus only seen in the trailer as like maybe a younger guy? Well, he's probably not there. So the world needs a new hero or something like that. I have no idea. I just read this online. But
it's Mateen the second who's in it now.
Looks like it, but we'll see. We'll see. It's nice to have something super mysterious that the film Twitter kind of cult is all fired up about, because it feels like every blockbuster that
it
comes along now.
Care.
Is, yeah.
You know what my favorite thing is? It's this thing that Will Smith did. It's a video where he's interviewed talking about how he turned down The Matrix. And he reenacts the pitch meeting that the Wachowskis gave him and why he turned it down. They were like imitating the speed time cameras
and
trying to tell him about how it was the bullet time, how he was going to be in the, you know, he was going to play, I forgot all this.
Neo,
he was supposed to play the Keanu Reeves character.
Yeah.
And if he had, then the character played by Lawrence Fishburne would have been played by someone else.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating to think about that, because for Will Smith, he was doing like Men in Black back then. It would have been a real turning point for him.
Wild West, and he regrets
it,
obviously. So, a very bad, probably
he had
the worst
a rough
movie
patch
that
there.
He ever made. I saw that movie, and I can attest to what a terrible piece of shit it was.
Well, speaking of Will Smith, the real reason we're here today is to digest our experience, tell you right, and look ahead to Toronto as this fall season continues to get more complicated, and we really do see a rather fascinating award season take shape. So we came out of Telluride, I think the last time we recorded, we kind of knew this anyway, but Will Smith at the center of King Richard was undeniably the most uniformly embraced thing that happened there.
So
I mean, Power of the Dog
too. Of the best actor race at the moment. And the movie itself, directed by Rinaldo Marcus Green, is actually a really well-made, authentic, gritty, grounded Compton movie. It could have been Hollywoodized and glossified in this awful kind of mainstream way. And of course, you know, there are folks who describe this movie as mainstream. That's because it's actually a movie that plays and works, and audiences at Telluride loved it. And what was so great about Telluride, Eric, was to come out of the end of that festival, having sat through the movies live with other people and having wandered around talking to people about what they liked and didn't like, and have a sense at the end of the festival of what really played and what really worked.
Yeah,
and I felt like
something,
I had a confidence about that I haven't had all year.
Exactly. I mean, it was something that couldn't, it's that kind of messy organic process through which you are both talking to people at parties, some of whom might even be famous or influential in different kinds of ways. Certainly a lot of whom are Academy members, but also hearing people in line, hearing how the audience reacts, things that simply cannot be replicated in the virtual format. That's been a fascinating new addition to the identity of festivals, but would not have allowed us to have the information that we have now about what resonated. Power of the Dog, for example, a film that is more, I would say, challenging, let's say, than King
it's
Richard
dark.
For some people,
and,
but
very
also
rigorous.
Really. Yeah. So we know it's not for everyone necessarily, but it was a very respected film. I will say I heard different reactions of people on that film towards the end of the festival because it had gathered buzz.
That's a hard sit. And one of the things, it's an intellectual exercise in a way. I mean, it's the kind of thing, it's cerebral. It's the kind of thing where at the end of it
which is my jam, you know?
I know, me too. You put it all together and you go, whoa, that's so cool. And there's so much to discuss. And this is not a filmmaker who hits you over the head with what you're supposed to think. You have to figure it out for yourself and even debate it. And I did an interview with her where I did write it up, and it was fun. It was so much fun to talk to her and ask her questions about what did this mean and what was Cody Smith McPhee doing walking in front of all those cowboys twice? What was he thinking when he did that? There's questions that she isn't even willing to answer. In you know, she told me what she thought, but it doesn't mean we have to make up our own minds, and that's the point.
Yeah,
she doesn't tell you what to think.
I think that is a valuable aspect of what makes the movie so compelling. I do also think that it's a movie designed to challenge people on many different levels, including by taking that Western milieu and doing something totally different with it, which
she
is
doesn't
like
think it's a Western at all.
It's definitely using the tropes of the Western.
She knows cinematically that it's a Western. What she was saying basically was that the book isn't a Western. It's set in 1925. It's about these businessmen, these ranchers. In the book, they wear suits, right? And in the movie, only Jesse Plemons wears suits. And everything she did to make up that Benedict Cumberbatch look was from movies and research, and she knows, you know, from the period what people wore, you know, putting on woolly chappies and everything. She knew she was playing with the Western as a
especially when
genre.
Yeah, when you dress a guy up in leather and you think about the fact that this movie is to some degree about someone's sexual identity being
in closeted
flux.
Gay man.
Yeah, I mean it's. Yeah. Spoiler alert, I guess. I don't know. But it is taking certain images from the Western and exploring their connotations in a way that I think is fresh and exciting. So that's going to be a fun one to talk about.
Well, you got to talk to Cumberbatch.
I did. And it was first time
to him about playing a straight man, playing a gay man.
Yeah. Which is something that for many reasons is applicable to this movie, not only for his character, but Cody Smith McPhee. And I should say that people who think that's a spoiler, it's not really a spoiler. I mean, from a plot standpoint, there's something else that happens in this movie that would be a spoiler in terms of motivation and the sources of intrigue towards the end. That is really what makes it, I think, a satisfying narrative experience. But I think he was very well spoken on this subject. I don't think it's something he's going to get lambasted for in some ways because, you know, Jane Campion made a very specific decision, and of course, she herself is going to be very well spoken on this. But I am curious to see how this film comes out in the world. Just like King Richard, we know King Richard will be a crowd pleaser.
It's still coming out on Warner Brothers, day and date, and it's such a shame that this movie doesn't have a chance. It may be a theatrical hit anyway. Sometimes movies go out on PVOD and do okay. But this is in theaters at the same time that the marketing enhances each venue. But I still wish this could have been a real good old-fashioned Between the Coasts. Big, big hit with the African-American audience. Everybody's going to go to this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it's just the African-American audience.
Iconic figures, the Williams sisters.
Yeah, and there's a tennis audience. I mean, there's a tennis channel audience. I mean, that's a hugely popular sport, and people obviously know those characters, but they don't know necessarily this origin story, and they know Will Smith. So there's so many different layers of access. So it'll be fascinating to see what does the HBO Max component do to a movie like this that should be the kind of thing that you go see at a movie theater. Power of the Dog is a great theatrical experience too. I mean, it's got a Johnny Greenwood score. It's a very ominous film that uses stillness and also, you know, punctuates it with action and violence and in very, you know, striking kinds of ways with these large canvas images. So, I mean, I'm going to try to go see that again at New York Film Festival.
Can't wait to
when it
unravel
plays
that one again.
So, so we've got those. And then there was Spencer, which when we recorded last time I'd seen and you were looking forward to. So
that became one of the big ticket items at Telluride. It was like the hot ticket because, of course, Power of the Dog and Spencer had built up a lot of buzz out of Venice. And then they showed up, traveled across the pond, came to Telluride. You got to see Kristen Stewart. I did not. Sure. But I did run into Pablo Larraín a couple times. It's a wonderful movie. I loved it. It's like my second favorite movie of the festival. But that's one that was even more polarizing with the audience than Power of the Dog was.
Well, think about the hype in this sense. I mean, people, about something like 100 people were turned away from this movie. Were they going because they are Princess Di fans or because they wanted to see Kristen Stewart doing something? Probably a lot of different kinds of reasons. They weren't necessarily going to see this ghostly kind of fantastical take surreal on the character. Very surreal, kind of body horror. But then it also has a kind of escapist quality because it allows you to live with the idea or to sit with the idea of her almost in this heroic context of escaping the royals. That's so it. It's fun to talk about and why
I
they creatively did
movie,
it.
But you
I think it's
to
a misdirect.
To embrace it as an art film, let's just be honest.
And fantasy.
And it's totally made up. Stephen Knight is, you know, it's fictionalizing something that happened, but we certainly don't know what went on behind closed doors. And I just think Kristen Stewart was incredibly good. I've been a fan of hers for a long, long time. I've always thought she was a very capable actress, and this doesn't surprise me at all. She really runs with it. But there is going to be a little bit of a disconnect because this is not a mainstream movie.
So it's fascinating. You mentioned Kristen Stewart being around, and I didn't get a sit down interview with her, unfortunately. So hopefully we rectify that at some point.
Time.
But there is time. But she was around. She worked the room at a Neon event, and then did a panel later and some Q&As and stuff. But what was fascinating to me was that she's an actress who, as people often note, every time she does something really impressive, people act like they're sort of discovering her talent again. It's just like an ongoing challenge.
Look at those SAS films that she did, like Personal Shopper and The Clouds of Sils Maria.
She wouldn't have this role without those films. I mean, those are the ones that really... Yeah, they tap into the essence of her, especially Personal Shopper shows how, you know, she can be sort of inscrutable in a really fascinating way. And she brings that to Diana. But obviously, this is a role that, like a traditional biopic, she brought a lot of research. She figured out how to get inside the mindset and the physicality of the person and stuff. So, you know, there may be some other contenders in the best actress category, and we could talk about those, but it would be kind of shocking if she didn't finally get her first nomination after what she's been doing.
Absolutely. She will. And Cumberbatch will. I think Cumberbatch and Stewart and Will Smith are all in the running. I think Peter Dinklage is too. Cyrano is definitely not... A unanimously beloved movie because you have to be into it. You have to be into that kind of theatrical, musical, overtly visual. You have to be into what Joe Wright does for a living. But Dinklage, I think, could break through.
I want to talk about something else, which is that, you know, there it almost seems like there's a festival within the festival at Telluride that is sort of the Oscar machine doing its thing. And then we go there and then we come out of it and we can't help but have these conversations. But
it was not the only thing that the festival is trying
It's not the only thing.
Buzz building for things going on to Toronto.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to point out. I guess the thing is, it's like we had a year off from the way this system usually works. There is no Golden Globes this year, so presumably you're not going to see the same kind of, you know, sort of silly HFPA events. But I did wonder, with all of the dinners and the mixers and stuff and the celebrities kind of doing
the
their
Academy
thing. Yeah, it does feel a bit like people are really leaning into how can we charm all the Academy members as much as possible in these physical events now. Because,
the other movie, by the way, that did very well was Belfast, as I predicted. And Kenneth Branagh and Jamie Dornan were working.
They worked
rooms.
It. Yeah.
And they turned on the charm And I have to say, they're good at it too. The other person who was working the festival was Simon Rex, the star of Red Rocket, which we both saw at Cannes.
He was working the festival. He was working the dance floor. He was working the
grease. Talk about what you saw on the dance floor. I was at this party. So this is the Lost Daughter party, Maggie Gyllenhaal's film, and her husband, Peter Sarsgaard, who's in the movie, very sexy and alluring in the movie, went and programmed a selection of music for the dancing, and everybody they got it all started, and everybody joined in. After I left, Cumberbatch showed up, right?
Oh yeah, he was on the dance floor. It was fascinating to me. It was like, I don't know who anticipated this, but there were journalists, whether it was myself or some of the other folks in the room, who were kind of in the center of the action, were these, you know, relatively well-known people, whether it's Maggie Gyllenhaal or whoever, were just letting loose on the dance floor and having this great time. You usually don't see that, but on some level, it felt like it was
on
the
Oscar night. Yeah, Golden Globes night. That's when you see it.
When you're sort of feeling free to let loose a little bit.
Absolutely.
And in this particular case, it kind of felt like, okay, so we had to show a proof of a negative test and we had to be vaccinated to get in the room in the first place. So suddenly it was like, who cares who's here? We can actually party in a way that we haven't in a long time.
It was very, very much
a release. So, you know, I started to pick up on
too.
These details. Yeah,
you Simon
danced,
Rex.
I danced. Simon Rex was working it. You saw so many people who were just, you know, going all out and having a great time. Although I did feel on some level like, are we here to do the work we're here to do, or are we here just to let loose on this dance floor? Like, it almost felt like we were getting further removed from the kind of like practical function of the festival, and it became just about like, let's enjoy the moment.
It's all part of returning to normal and living with COVID at the same time. And so you have these practical concerns. I sent in, a test, you know, a COVID test today via FedEx, you know, and I was fascinated by the Netflix COVID test, which was really super duper. You could do it at home for half an hour and swab your own nose and stick it in a vial and stick it in this little machine and get a response back in 30 minutes.
Yeah,
it was amazing. Cool. But what I want to say is this. People were hugging a lot. People were really happy to see their friends. It's a film community, and it operated on all the different levels that you've described, and everyone was feeling the same thing. They were feeling really grateful and happy and almost, you know, comforted to be with each other. And I got to see some friends, and I got to do interviews, and I got to sit in movies shoulder to shoulder with people that I care about. And it just felt so great. And it felt great to be able to do my job too and have a sense of what was really going on, because you need audiences,
I guess,
and
so,
people to get that sense.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I guess what I'm trying to sort out is that there is still an issue with the degree to which the kind of large scale award season complex can dictate the most exciting moments at the festival. Like, to me, okay, I saw the bigger movies, and we've talked about them, and we'll be talking about them a lot. But the most exciting moments for me were the discoveries, something like Marcel the Shell, which I've talked about.
Top of
or
that
Bitter
paid
Brush.
Very well, by the way, at the end of the festival, everyone was talking about it.
Or Bitter Brush, which was a documentary that is another sales title about women cowgirls in Idaho.
Yeah, I saw that before I left.
On the off season, beautiful film. So these kinds of movies, as we head into Toronto, which, you know, unfortunately we're not on the ground there, but again, one fraction of the lineup are these bigger movies. So much more about the festival environment is actually built around discovery. It has to be for the launch pad of so many of these films. So something that I come out of the pandemic thinking is, what can we do to make sure that we don't sort of spend the entire season, especially the season that's sort of dominated by the Oscar conversation, exclusively focusing on these movies? Because we know that's not it. That's not the whole story.
Look, I'm looking forward. So what's going on is we're back from TIFF. Listen to me. We're back from the Telluride.
And about to get into
TIFF.
On top
of us. Yes.
Yep. So we're in it now.
There's a virtual screening platform, as they did last year. So we're back on there. There are a lot of films on there. Sony Pictures Classics has all their films on there. So I'm looking forward to seeing Compartment 6, which was one of the films from Cannes that I missed. One of the films I missed in Telluride is the Electrical Life of Lewis Wayne, which is another Cumberbatch movie that he produced. I'm looking forward to catching
up with that at TIFF. A cat person
right.
movie.
So there's all sorts, you know, there's The Guilty is at TIFF, Eyes of Tammy Faye is at TIFF. You know, there's lots of stuff. I'm already, you know, booking interviews and getting going on that. So that's the next hill.
But for me, it's like all that is great. But I also, I feel like the danger is that in looking at just those movies, we don't realize sometimes how much more there is to the festival. I mean, like what I'm looking forward to is a documentary called Beba. That's a first time feature in the documentary section. That's sort of a personal story about a woman dealing with her Latin American heritage and how she's assimilating into the United States, which sounds super timely, has, you know, no real track record. It really needs festival buzz to get out there. That's the kind of stuff that really excites me. It's something like that, or Earwig from Lucille Hazhelalovich. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing her last name, but I really liked her last film, Evolution. She does these crazy body horror films from a young woman's perspective. And after Titane, I'm all about that. So Titane's going to be in the midnight section in Toronto. So, you know,
oh,
are these awards
can
movies?
See that. That's exciting. It wasn't a Telluride. Well, that's a must see, of course, from Julia Ducournau. The thing about Red Rocket and Titane is that they're both movies that are so outrageous in some ways and in terms of their subject matter. That I hope everybody checks them out. There were walkouts Red Rocket, but people also loved it. And
well, it was fun to talk about.
It's going to have the same impact.
Yeah, they're fun to talk about. I mean, and I guess the other part of it is this question of, you know, if Titane doesn't become the French Oscar submission, is it still something that we can spend award season talking about because we think it deserves recognition?
It's one of the best movies of the year, and I'm expecting the critics at the end of the year to reward
it.
I'm really counting on it. And remember, we've talked about this already, the Gothams and the Spirits are going to be more important now that the Critics' Choice Awards are going to be more important now that the Golden Globes are no longer part of the picture. The thing about the Golden Globes, not to make too much of it, but they did bring up
something of it.
they did introduce people into the conversation that were sometimes worthy, and so that's the function of these other award shows, is to introduce people and make sure that they're seen.
Well, I always, like I've said in the past, I always appreciate that we have the Gotham Awards, that we have the critics groups in particular, because the processes behind them are less dictated by FYC campaigns and more by kind of what people are seeing, what they're talking about. And that's a more open-ended system. Then
sometimes
you know,
it leads films to
it.
Actually build up to real awards momentum. Remember, you talk about FYCs and you talk about how people spend and you talk about how we talk too much about the awards, which I agree with you totally. And if we can find other things to talk about, I'm happy to do it. But the point is that all of this is a function of getting those Academy voters to actually see the movies if we want them to get into that race.
Well, you know, we were on the street with an Academy voter who we don't have to name, who was saying, you know, I get really frustrated when I see the same people all the time getting those DGA nominations, for example. Like there is a sense within the Academy from people who don't want this sense of, you know, predictability.
But the director's branch of the Academy is one of the good ones in terms of recognizing people from other countries, like
at least they do
Almodovar and Pavlikovsky and Cuarón and Iñárritu
and they'll have plenty of options this time. I mean, you could see Julia Ducournau, Pedro Almodovar with his movie that opened Venice. You got Jane Campion. I mean, there's plenty of good options. The question is what's going to get in the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of my discoveries out of Telluride included El Gran Feove, which is a Cuban music documentary. directed by, of all people, Matt Dillon. But he did a really, really good job. And I interviewed him up there. This guy is a major music nerd. Imagine someone on the level of Barry Levinson and Diner, you know, that kind of you know, just huge catalog of knowledge that he put to use in this wonderful story of this Cuban musician who goes to Mexico. Feyobe, a scat musician. And then the other, did you see the Peter Hedges?
I didn't see that. Was the one that was in Zoom, right? It was a, that's right. A pandemic
that's
movie.
Right. That was a very innovative, the same storm. And that's it's definitely a COVID movie shot during the pandemic. And it's an odd thing that's written, but acted very realistically via Zoom windows. And with each other, responding live to each other.
May it be the last and best, so we can move on.
It needs distribution,
right?
That's up for grabs.
It certainly was fascinating.
I could see a streamer taking it. Yeah.
So. I mean, I was fascinated by seeing movies that were made in the past year that were not in Zoom, thankfully, but were certainly made during the pandemic, and you could
see Belfast is one.
Yeah, a lot of them were, and they were smaller in some ways or more personal in others. It kind of felt like you didn't have to explicitly acknowledge what was going on in the past year for people to be tackling subject matters that were like a direct extension of that. And so, you know, one benefit to the award season thing and people repeating themselves over and over again as they promote things is that the conversation may end up being directed towards like moving forward, how you've become a better artist or more in touch with the kind of stories you want to tell. And that seems like a constructive direction for everybody to go. So
I think, you know, I'm sure you had the same conversations. I was definitely picking up from a lot of the artists I talked to a sense that the pandemic changed them and made them want to spend their time on things that they really cared about and not waste it on things that didn't matter to them. And I think that could have an enormous impact. By the way, this is just the tip of the iceberg, what we've seen. Yep. These are the films that happen to be finished in time.
Just getting started.
There's a whole lot of other stuff that got written and hasn't even been made yet, or stuff that got made that hasn't been finished yet. One movie that I'm curious to know what you thought about is the Mike Mills, Come On, Come On.
Yeah, we watched that together. I mean, it's beautiful. The black and white cinematography is amazing. I liked it in bits and pieces. I thought that it had a hard time driving home the overall kind of point about Joaquin Phoenix sort of as the uncle to this like overeducated kid he's been forced
by him spoiled, pampered, and bratty too.
Yeah, well, there's that too. But I mean, he's very well spoken because his mother, played by Gabby Hoffman, quite well, I thought.
She was good.
Has raised him that way.
The actors were all good. The actors did a great job.
I think it's got some really good moments where it captures the issue with a child being raised that way. He's still a kid, even though he's been sort of taught to think like an adult. And when you see those disconnects around New York City, you know, he has tantrums. Joaquin's character loses him sometimes. It is really affecting. And I think it arrives somewhere that is emotionally resonant. So I appreciate that. Mike Mills films always have this delicate touch. I just wish that there was a little bit more
for me.
There was a little, it's sort of lacking a through line, I think, overall.
That's a reason for engagement. I mean, I would say one of the films that really didn't play well at the festival was, as I had predicted, Eric, was The French Dispatch. And in each case, I think the problem is the same. They are beautiful, extraordinarily difficult to pull off, gorgeous visuals. And you know that there's an enormous amount of skill involved, and yet they lack engagement. That goes with the territory when you have short stories strung together. But in this case, it's this long sort of rambling road movie that doesn't really pay off.
Well, it's not a road movie, but Robbie Ryan
happened to be city locations.
Robbie Ryan is the cinematographer.
Robbie Ryan, of course.
He did an amazing job using black and white, I think, to sort of accentuate some of the feel of the movie. And I really love that Joaquin is this sort of like documentary audio documentary journalist of sorts, and it looks like they're interviewing real kids for the project.
Part was fun.
It's very involving in bits and pieces. I also often say that Consensus is boring. I don't care if French Dispatch didn't play well at Telluride. I can't wait to see it again. I think it's super engaging in a way that Wes Anderson films usually are, and it's his most liberated. It doesn't try to coalesce into a single narrative. He just creates a world and plays around.
Budapest Hotel. What he did there was a similar feat in terms of using the Ralph Fiennes character to unite all the different stories that swirled around him, and you would go off on these detours, but you always came back to the central location and the central character. That doesn't happen here. It doesn't work.
It does. There is a wraparound. The wraparound is the Bill Murray character, who at the beginning of the movie, not a spoiler alert, is dead. And yet you see him pop up as a recurring character throughout, and you see his investment in the stories that are happening. And then by the end of the movie, you care. I cared about his role in making those stories impactful. And I do think there is some truth to that. It's just a different movie. It's not, I think it's you know, we always do this. We say when somebody makes a movie we love, we say, oh, this one isn't as good as that one. And I don't know in this particular case.
This is repetitive. Or we say,
I didn't find it repetitive at all. It certainly isn't repetitive.
Repetitive of his previous work. I'm talking about,
I didn't find that at all.
Last night I watched for whatever reason, I watched Woody Allen's Rainy Day in New York. The reason is that I'm looking
I knew we were going to get around to this.
speaking to Timothy Chalamet at some point about Dune. That would be my hope. Which I loved. Loved Dune. David.
We can argue about that one.
A very witty review, which is very entertaining, but I disagree with him profoundly. In any case,
it's kind of dull.
If you look at a Woody Allen movie these days, this has been true for a long, long time. It's a formula, you know, from the typeface on the graphics at the beginning of the movie to the way that the music is used, the way that he always has this character doing a running monologue across the course of the movie, that it's a male character who's some kind of surrogate for his voice, who has to try to make his voice work. And then there's various women that are being hit on by various men in the movie. This is all Woody Allen, and it's always the same, and it never changes, rarely. So,
well, you know, he had that period.
I think Wes Anderson is in danger of becoming that guy.
I don't know if that's fair.
He's doing the same thing every time.
I just don't find that at all. I mean, look, first of all, Woody Allen had that amazing period in the 80s where he certainly was
changed. We love those periods.
Moving around.
We love that period. And
Wes Anderson's not a very old guy.
After another. But when was the last good Woody Allen movie?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, Midnight in Paris wasn't that long ago, and he won the Oscar for that.
Let me change the word. Great. Let's say great.
Let's say, like, at a certain level. I would say that the most overall gratifying piece of filmmaking he did was probably Match Point, which wasn't that long ago.
I didn't care for Match Point, so my last one was Deconstructing Harry.
Well, that's a long time ago.
To my mind,
that one divided people.
Great Woody Allen movie.
That one did divide people, though. It's the most uncomfortable he's been on camera, I think, ever. So, but look, we will probably be arguing about Wes Anderson films, hopefully, for years to come. He's not that old of a guy.
He's
Woody Allen's in his late 80s.
He's got a lot of gifts, and I'm looking forward to seeing him try something new. Look, the other one I loved was God, don't help me. The animated one with the dogs.
Fox.
Isle of Dogs.
Isle of Dogs?
And I love the Fantastic Mr. Fox, too. I love those movies.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, he doesn't have to win you over every time to be in danger of losing his touch or whatever. Maybe he doesn't get you every time. But this one, I'm happily going to be the one to keep pushing back, because I think it's got a lot going on.
It may have been a mistake, though, for Searchlight to take it to Telluride.
Yes, that's actually a perfect movie. And New York Film Festival, I would say.
Exactly. So what did they need Telluride for? Yeah.
Who knows? In any case, so next week, we'll be on the other side of TIFF, and we'll have a bunch to talk about. I mean, we'll see what wins the audience prize. Always a fascinating open question, even in a year like this. And you'll be checking out the awards tributes. So they've got Jessica Chastain and a bunch of others that you're going to be looking at.
And Villeneuve.
So we'll see what kind of impact that has. And we'll be trading notes. We may not be hoofing it on the streets of Canada, but we certainly hope that it goes well. Yeah, we'll be all
Thanks,
over it.
Thanks, Eric.
Bye.
Talk to you anon.
Indeed.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.